to enjoy it, but thought rather grimly, oh, we're going to have to do that, aren't we? And so rapidly got caught up in all the debates about women bishops and things. And over the last couple of years ago, really the theme of women in the church, which I never expected to be a particular theme of mine, but seems to have suddenly ended up as something of a vocation, has come together with my interest in history. I've bought a couple of my books with me, not because I'm expecting to buy them with your students, but I thought my life would look when they get out of the library. I've just published a book called The Essential History of Christianity, which is a really short, it's like Dermot McCulloch condensed. It's a really short overview of the whole of Christian history from Jesus to now. Which terrified me when I started it, but it's good. So I'm not going to do the whole of Christian history today. When I tweeted earlier that I was doing this talk, a couple of people said, and I tweeted the title, a couple of people said, what, apart from being the first witness of the resurrection, the mother of Jesus, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. I'm focusing on theologians, and particularly the recovery of women theologians who have often been marginalised. One of the things that's happened a lot in the last few years, the last few decades really, has been the rediscovery of how important women were in writing and creating Christianity. And they have been forgotten and marginalised, sometimes accidentally, sometimes deliberately. Let's start with this. I love this cartoon. What terrifies religious extremists like the Taliban and not American tanks or bullets? It's a girl with a book. It's Malala who was shot trying to go to school. And I suppose it starts off with the question, what is it about women's education and women's thinking and writing that does scare people? Because it's undeniable that it does. And it's not just Islam, but the same has happened in Christianity as well, particularly from about 1200 onwards. And you might like to ask yourself a further question, what is it about religions that means that women's thinking and writing and intellect seems to have particularly scared or scandalised people of faith throughout history? It's not always been the case. In medieval Christian tradition, a girl with a book is really how it all starts. So it's what a classic picture of the Annunciation. I've got a couple of examples. Traditionally, pictures of the Annunciation show Gabriel interrupting Mary in the act of reading. It's because in the Middle Ages, a woman reading her prayer book, her primer, was the new standard of women's spirituality, lay spirituality, but particularly of women's spirituality. There was a huge increase in around 1200, with the increase in towns, in lay literacy. Suddenly a lot more people were reading. The rise of standard of living after Black Death, urbanisation and so on, all combined to mean there was a much, much higher rate of functional literacy. And there was an explosion in the popularity of books of ours, you know, these beautiful illuminated manuscripts, but they came in much cheaper copies as well. They were previously only found in monasteries, and then they increasingly became popular with the better off laity. Obviously, all the people in these pictures are wearing very, very smart and upper class clothing. And people began to follow this sort of daily monastic round of prayer in their own home. And even before printing started, there were mass production workshops that were producing very, very cheap copies, so these became quite quickly available to the bourgeoisie, I suppose, really appropriate term. There were big, particularly in Paris, big workshops where people in a sort of industrial Henry Ford copying process would each have their own page, copy it out, pass it to the next person, copy it out. And they had little bespoke woodcuts as well. So you could order a copy, and you could, tuppence for the plain black and white copy, threepence for the one with illustrations, or a shilling for the one with the more elaborate illustrations. So they were still expensive, but they were, I've made those prices up by the way, they're not accurate. But they were within the reach of the mercantile classes and the artisan classes. And reading a primer became the standard of lay spirituality, especially for women. And you can see that in this explosion of depictions of the Annunciation, where Mary's interrupted at her prayer desk. And it's a really interesting question, given Mary is such a prominent figure in the Christian tradition, a figure who's routinely depicted both as very holy and as educated, clearly literate, choosing to read. Why does Christianity seem sometimes to have a problem with educated, literate, thinking women? I think these pictures suggest it wasn't always the case in the past, and if so, when and why did that change? And also women contributed to the development of Christian thinking over the past. I'm going to begin properly. I'm about 10 pages down in my other, that's the problem with these things. With a quote. It's a very long quote to put up on the I'll let you read it because it's a lot quicker. Someone stick a hand up when you've got the bottom. Hazard a guess as to its date and authorship. It was written by a woman called Christine de Pizan in 1405. Christine was a court poet. Sometimes she's identified as the first professional woman writer in Europe. She'd been married when she was 15, she had cut three children, her husband died when she was 25, and she thought, how's she going to make ends meet to feed the children? Started writing poetry, made a reasonable success of it, became appointed as a court poet in France, and supported herself and her children as a writer and poet. And this is from the beginning of a book called The City of Ladies, which was published in 1405. And began life as a riposte to the Romance of the Rose. We've heard of the Romance of the Rose. It was a very, very famous medieval ballad published just before this. And the Romance of the Rose, one of these typical chivalric, long narrative poems, she identified it as being a deeply misogynistic text because its basic premise is that all women in it are either temptresses or adulterers. And the men go around either trying to seduce them and succeeding, or being tempted by them and then repenting, and so on. And she was very angry about this, particularly because it was so popular for kind of 50 Shades of Grey at this time. And she wrote this book in riposte to it, to counteract it. She starts it at the beginning in true academic form. I really enjoy reading this. She really sounds like an academic, doesn't she? She starts with a literature review. I've read all these books, and they all say this, all these great authors all say this. And goes on, similarly in academic fashion, saying, well, actually, I have something different to say. It's like the beginning of any standard academic article. She says she's confused by this. It doesn't fit with her experience of women. Identifies the data a bit too closely, but she says, I looked at all the women of my acquaintance, princesses, court ladies, ladies of the middle classes and peasants, and none of them are like that. They're all trying to be virtuous and godly and good Christians. And why does this happen? And it also, she says, it doesn't fit with her understanding of God, who doesn't create evil things. And then it goes on, just skip over these bits, in the letter, no, no. This is an illustration from it. It goes on, O God, how can this be? Unless I stray from my faith, I must ever doubt the infinite wisdom of your perfect goodness ever created anything which was not good. Yet look at all these accusations which have been judged, decided, and concluded against women. I don't know how to understand this repugnance. If it is so fair, Lord God, that so many abominations abound in the female sex, for you yourself say the testimony of two or three witnesses lends credence, why should I doubt it was true? Why did you not let me be born as a man? And then she says, she considered herself extremely unfortunate. And the rest of that, so she starts off by saying, everything she reads has at least a passage in it about how hopeless women are, how we all know the kind of things that many authors were saying about women, they're vessels of temptation, they're deeply polluted, they're not as rational as men are, etc., etc. And this doesn't fit with their experience or with their understanding of God. As I said, she was very upset, and the rest of the book is then constructed around a kind of conversation with three mythical figures, three mythological ladies, Lady Reason, Lady Rectitude, and Lady Justice, who help her, in this typical medieval conceit, to construct a city made of women. So here are the three ladies. I'm not quite sure what their holding represents. But they're helping her to construct a city made of ladies, and the book is the city, and each of these stories that she then tells of a virtuous woman is a brick building a city, that's the conceit. So it collects together stories of virtuous women, and it's quite interesting because it collects together stories of women in classical mythology as well as in Christian history, and stories of saints and so on. It's a typical medieval combination, demonstrating how great and righteous women can be and how foolish it is to think the opposite. And it's a book that shows very clearly that debates about the role of women in creation and the role of women in writing theology aren't just a modern phenomenon. These debates have actually been going on throughout history. And it's a very good example of some of the issues surrounding the contribution that women have made to Christian theology over history. Women's theological writing has often been in genres that have only quite recently been recognised as actually being theology. Women have, at least since about the 12th century, been by definition laity, not clergy. There was a very significant change in the 1100s in the way that the Catholic Church defined who was laity and who were clergy. There's an excellent book on this by Gary Macy, it's on the list, I'll get out in a sec. And up until then, all sorts of people were ordained to all sorts of things. Men and women were both ordained. There are lots of ordination rites for women, ordaining them as deaconesses, or as abbesses, or as, lectors, all sorts of things. And similarly, there are ordination rites for men, two jobs that we wouldn't necessarily consider to be ordained now. So you're ordained to be a reader in church, you're ordained to be a doorkeeper. Ordination rites that are still there in the Vatican archives and other archives. But ordination was redefined in the 12th century as being very, very narrowly about making Christ present in the Mass. And anything that wasn't about doing that wasn't ordination. And so almost incidentally, women were laicized at a stroke. And so their writings suffered and flourished along with those of lay men as spiritual fashions disallowed lay theology. Similarly, you might come back to this, universities were also being established in the same period. And that led to a very dramatic professionalisation of theological learning and theological research. and universities were by definition male-only institutions. And so again, up until that point, women had very often worked in monasteries, in nunneries, double monasteries, and that was where the seat of theological learning was. Suddenly, theology was moved either into the clergy or into the university, and both of those were places that women were excluded from. And so they were almost incidentally marginalised. Also, women have often discussed issues about women. They've often discussed women. Not always, and they've discussed many other things as well, but they have often also mentioned women and talked about women, talked about maternity, talked about the spirituality of women's bodies and so on. And to the extent that those have often not been issues that the mainstream theological or ecclesiastical establishment wants to be discussed, just as the Roman Catholic Church now refuses to allow official Roman Catholic theologians to discuss whether women can be ordained or not, women have been marginalised, sometimes deliberately and sometimes simply by the kind of academic death by lack of citation. If you're not, you've not chosen a fashionable field, where do you go? It's the Darwinianism of academia. And the growth of feminist approaches to history and theology in the last few decades has led to a real revitalising of Christian theology by the recovery and the critical appreciation of women's voices from the past. It's not just done by feminist theologians and historians. It was the growth of feminism that initially started off its whole interest in gender studies all across the academy. But once people had said, oh, actually, there might be some women out there, what's interesting to say? Of course, what's happened is that a lot of people who've been looking for PhD subjects and need to have something new and original to publish on have gone looking for them. Perfect subject for a PhD or for a nice article to find a woman theologian that was neglected and rehabilitate her. And so there's been an absolute explosion in rediscovery of a lot of these women in the last few decades. Should I give these handouts out now, actually, and then anything else I refer to is on here. There was a very early book, a very influential, you might have heard of, Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza. There was a book called In Memory of Her, which focused on the women in the Bible, focused particularly on the women who are either barely mentioned in the Bible or aren't mentioned but whose presence can be inferred. For example, in the Synoptic Gospels refer to the feeding of 5,000 or the feeding of 10,000, whichever version you're reading. And a couple of them say, you know, there were 5,000 men there besides women and children. It's astonishing, because it would have made a much better story to have counted the women and children. It would have made the miracle more impressive. But they literally weren't counted. So she went around looking for where women were clearly there. You could infer their presence, but they weren't mentioned. She was one of the first people to do that. And since then, it's become completely part of mainstream biblical scholarship and preaching to note the presence of women in biblical texts. It is still relatively common to see lists of major theologians or to go and buy an anthology of Christian writings and find either that there are no women included or that women are represented by St. Julian of Norwich. You know, there's one or two. And when you challenge that with someone who's editing one of these things, what they tend to say is, well, sadly, that's just the way the world was. You know, the way the world was in the past meant that women didn't have the education, they didn't have the opportunities, so the giants of Christian theology were all men, and there's not a lot we can do about that. And I used to believe that. But then I started thinking, actually, as I say, I'm a historian first, and in history, we've almost entirely discarded the great man way of doing history. We don't tend anymore to write books that talk about the kings and the influential men of that. You know, divide history up into purely people's lifetimes. We've abandoned that in history in favour of a much more nuanced and multivocal approach, looking at all sorts of different records, looking at household accounts and accounts of customs in markets and things, to try and find out what people's wills and people's household inventories and all sorts of things like that, to try and get a sense of what was really going on for the normal people. historians are really used nowadays to seeking out these stories and voices of the normal members of society who in the kind of old model of history were having history done to them. And that's not how we think about it anymore. And the same is beginning to happen in theology, as theologians have gone looking for women and indeed lay men, who've also been largely ignored in the past. They found them, working away in whatever ways were deemed culturally acceptable and open to them. Let's say, to understand how it came about that women were marginalised, do you need to grasp just how important the changes were that took place in about the 11th, 12th century? A huge number of things came together. It's in one of the chapters of that book. Get it in the Bible. There were huge changes in church organisation and theology, and a big confluence of factors in social and economic history and political history that all came together in the 11th and 12th century and really completely transformed the landscape that people were doing theology in. I've already mentioned the universities developing, which led to the development of academic theology. It hadn't existed until then. Until then it was all monastic and clerical and people writing. I mentioned the development of towns and the development of lay literacy. There was also, in this period, a huge reassertion of papal power. We tend to think, oh, the popes through the Middle Ages, they were just there all the time. Really wasn't the case up until about 1100. But they created a mythology for themselves that was then read back into the past to say, oh yes, we've been the pope ever since, you know, ever since Paul, Peter. But it really wasn't true, certainly after the fall of Rome in 450, up until about the 1100s. It was complete fantasy, and nobody even had that fantasy at that point. It was read back later. In about 1100, the papacy began trying to extend its authority. It started getting more organised. The various bits of Europe were getting themselves much more organised into the beginning of the nation states that then developed. So they stopped being, you know, France and sort of stopped being a collection of warring tribes and began to be more of a coherent thing. And as the different countries developed into nation states, the papacy started trying to assert authority. And you get all sorts of conflicts going on. You've heard of the Diet of Worms, presumably. Massive conflict about whether the king in Germany or the pope should be the person that gave the staff and ring to the bishop as a symbol of who was actually in charge of their appointment, who did they report to, who ultimately was their authority. And although solemn concessions were made to the pope, really the kings won that argument. Similarly, the debate about the situation of Thomas Becket here, all part of the same massive conflict between church and state, which went on for 200 or 300 years. And so that all went on, and that all combined in a re-clericalisation of the church. As the papacy were trying to assert power, one of the ways they tried to do that was by regaining more authority, by getting more control over the clergy and trying to make them more visibly different. And that's when they began trying to enforce clerical celibacy and so on. So all of those factors came together to professionalise and clericalise religious authority and who was allowed to be involved in theological inquiry. So pre-1200 and post-1200 are very, very different. Pre-1200, actually, there were huge amounts of women working, often on very equal terms with men, when we go looking for them now. A lot of those were deliberately written out of the record later, and others were just accidentally forgotten, or people interpreted references to them differently. For example, people looked at these ordination rites and said, well, of course they can't be ordained, they must have been kind of pretending. You know, because it was just a different view of ordination. And then after that period, women had to try and negotiate different ways of being involved in theology. So, for example, the amazing role of the early abbesses has been rediscovered in recent decades. There were quite a lot of double monasteries in the centuries before about 1000, which had communities of both monks and nuns. After about 1000, one of the things that papal reform did was to stop that. You had to either be male or female. But there were a lot of double monasteries before that period, particularly in England. And they were always headed by an abbess. Not quite sure why. I haven't been able to find out why. But they were always headed by an abbess in overall charge. The abbot was always under the abbess. The most famous example, of course, is Hilda of Whitby. And they were ordained to their posts and statuses as abbess. It was understood as a particular vocation and an order. I've got some examples here. There's a Saint Leoba with her crook. They were given a crook and some of them a mitre at their ordination. All given a crook and similar pastoral charge, just as bishops did. Some of them were given a mitre at their ordination, and this was those who had ecclesiastical jurisdiction over a large area, instead of the local bishop. In some places in France, even up until the 19th century, in Catholic areas where these haven't been abolished, in the 19th century there were two abbesses in France who had jurisdiction over the bishop. One of those things I forget. There were several ordination rites, they were invested with a mitre and a crook. They were responsible for lots of things that were later reserved to male clergy. Abbesses, for example, heard confessions, they pronounced blessings, they seem to have often resided at communion in their own communities, and they often held the ordinary jurisdiction for an area. And that was stopped in those trans-century reforms, when the understanding of ordination was changed by the papacy to try to enforce a male celibate priesthood. Abbesses were effectively criticised. They were stopped from being allowed to pronounce the absolution, and they were stopped from hearing confessions of their own nuns, and increasingly marginalised. This is Hilda of Whitby. Again, note the crook and the crown and the statue. Many of these abbesses were extremely learned theologians in their own rights, as well as presiding over learned communities and acting as patrons of theologians. Hilda of Whitby, we don't have particular writings of her, but she's best known for hosting the Synod of Whitby and as patron of the early English poet Caedmon. And it seems likely that Whitby was chosen as the venue for the Synod of Whitby because Hilda had established an amazing reputation as a thoughtful, learned, and reflective community leader. And so she's not known to have left theological writings, but it seems very likely that her theological insights were crucial in determining the decision of the king at that synod to follow Roman rather than Celtic customs, which is generally considered to be a decision, although some people are a bit nostalgic for Celtic Christianity, it's generally considered to have been a decision that meant that English Christianity was firmly in the forefront of Christianity in the Middle Ages, rather than becoming a backwater. There were lots of others who are known to have contributed as theologians in their writings. There's a very interesting article by Paul Rorem, it's on the reading list, in Theology Today. There was a special edition of Theology Today in 2003. And Rorem's article does a really great brief literature survey of a whole load of these. An earlier prolific example is, Crotswit. This is just a quick go through Google, which you've all these books about her. I've never heard of her at all before. She wrote, go back to Crotswit. Crotswit wrote huge amounts of stuff. She wrote Lives of the Saints, she wrote histories, she wrote brief dramas. Her dramas, Warren says, all her dramas of Christian martyrs and heroines, the early Christian women are noble, brave and wise, constantly outwitting the Roman men who are corrupt, evil and foolish. perhaps the best known is Hildegard of Bingen. This is from a contemporary illustration showing the Holy Spirit descending on her and inspiring her. She's best known for the prophetic visions that she had and that she wrote down. In some very popular books. She was a 12th century Benedictine abbess. She was a visionary, but she was an astonishing polymath. I mean, she was this incredible woman. People were stunned by her. She wrote all sorts of things, saints' lives, poetry, philosophy. She was a composer as well and wrote several hymns. And we don't know whether she drew or caused to be drawn. We think she, it's suspected that she directed the illustrations of the books of her visions, which are absolutely astonishing. There are three books of her visions, Scibias, Liber Vitae Meritorum, and Liber Divinorum Operum. She describes her visions and then she interprets them using biblical exegesis. She also, as I say, was a composer, and one of her works, the Ordo Virtutum, is a very early example of liturgical drama, probably the oldest surviving morality play, possibly the first morality play. She also wrote a book of natural science, invented a new alphabet, and invented a form of modified shorthand medieval Latin for the use of her nuns, and in her spare time founded two monasteries. The illustrations to her visions are absolutely astonishing. I mean, they're almost contemporary abstract. They're like nothing else I've seen in medieval art. This is, let's say, it's suspected that they were illustrated under her direction. She told people what to draw. Possible she did them herself. This is from the manuscript copy of Scibias. It's an illustration of the Trinity with concentric circles, two concentric circles representing Father, well, we're not quite sure whether it's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's probably Father, Holy Spirit, and Son. Very androgynous figure in the centre, and the blue circle penetrates this inner circle, a bit like an egg. So they're not entirely separate. Astonishingly abstract. What's another one? Just a quick Google brings up loads and loads of them. This is an illuminated copy of one of the hymns she wrote, which were incredibly popular. I mean, this is before printing, but these things were copied and circulated all around Europe. She was also a prolific letter writer, a preacher, and a reformer. And she was absolutely fearless in pointing out abuses and seeking reforms. Completely unafraid of any authority. She wrote letters to popes and kings and bishops and everybody telling them that when they're doing things wrong. She wrote to her own archbishop over some dispute. And so your malicious curses and threatening words are not to be obeyed. You have raised up your rod of punishment arrogantly, not to serve God, but to gratify your own perverted will. You have to be quite confident in your prophecy to write to your archbishop saying that. Quite an outstanding scholar, never mind being a woman. And she was beatified by the Roman Catholic Church in the medieval period. They never actually completed the formal sainthood process, but a lot of folks called her saints. And she was, in October 2012, very recently, Pope Benedict made her a doctor of the church. Only the fourth woman of 35 would be given that title. And when he did so, he called her perennially relevant as an authentic teacher of theology and a profound scholar of natural science and music. Another brilliant abbess was Heloise. She's someone people have often heard of because they've often heard the story of Heloise and Abelard. The story of Heloise and Abelard, one of these classic medieval love stories. But it's often told as Heloise had a love affair with Abelard. He gets caught by her. It's never quite clear whether she gets pregnant or not, I'm not quite sure. He gets caught by her guardian and is castrated and put in a monastery, and she retires to a monastery to a nunnery herself, where she languishes and they write letters. And this is, in the Victorian period, it became a kind of classic. I'll show you a picture in a moment of show you it now. It's a classic kind of Victorian romantic picture of Heloise and Abelard, or even worse, they're kind of languishing pathetically. She's known primarily as somebody who had a youthful love affair and an illicit marriage to Abelard. She's not, and that means that people have generally ignored the fact that she was an excellent theologian in her own right. Some commentators in the past have even said, oh, there's a correspondence between her and Abelard, which is the main text that's known. And some commentators have even speculated that Abelard was writing her side of it. Because it showed the mastery of the Latin epistolatory form and therefore couldn't hear it in my woman. But Abelard himself described her as the outstanding intellect of his acquaintance. And long after he died, she led her community very successfully and wrote some astounding books long after his death. But in fact, they seem to have had an extremely equal relationship, not like these pictures. A contemporary picture shows them as equals sitting and discussing. It's quite an interesting time. Heloise was born in around 1090 and died in 1164. So this is just in the period where women are beginning to be marginalised. And she was obviously aware of this, because one of the letters she wrote to Abelard discusses the fact that women's contribution to theology is being questioned and that women are being marginalised, and asks him to write a treatise on it. Again, we're not quite sure to what extent the treatise that he wrote was actually co-authored by her. And he wrote a treatise which argued very, very strongly that women should be allowed to do all sorts of things, that they can be ordained, that there's no reason why they can't, which, you know, within 10 or 20 years was completely suppressed, because that wasn't the way things were going. She was an absolutely brilliant scholar of Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, and had a reputation very widely as one of the leading minds of the day. There's a lot of people saying that about her in the contemporary literature. She became a nun, then a prioress, then an abbess, and she made very significant contributions to theological ethics, particularly of intention. You know, to what extent does one have to be intending something for it to be an ethical decision and so on. She was also a notable monastic reformer. It's quite interesting the extent to which a lot of these women are known for their reforms. So another reformer who changed the shape of the medieval church quite significantly was Clare of Assisi. Again, another reformer who's known primarily through her association with a man and has been marginalised by her collaboration with Francis of Assisi. Roughly contemporary in his portrait from an initial. Clare of Assisi, born about 1194, died in 1253. She was one of the first followers of Francis. She heard him preach one day and experienced profound conversion, and quite soon after secretly left her parents' house. She was a noble woman. They didn't want her to go and be a monk or a nun. And she took vows of poverty, and she founded the Order of Poor Ladies, which was a monastic religious order, but in the Franciscan tradition, so in the friar tradition, not here we are in a monastery, but we're going to be the mendicant tradition, you know, of poor friars who are going out, depending on alms for their living and so on, which wasn't considered a suitable way to live for women. But she was very determined that this was what she'd been called to do. She wrote their rule of life insisting on this. It's the first monastic rule known to have been written by a woman. And she successfully defended the order against successive attempts by popes and the local bishops to change the rule. They wanted her to make it a Benedictine nunnery, and she was absolutely determined for it to stay as a Franciscan friary. 2 days before her death, she finally received a papal bull confirming that the rule she'd written was to be accepted as the governing rule of the house. It seems clear she'd been hanging on for that when she died a couple of days later. And the order that she founded was renamed the Order of St. Clare after she died, normally known as the Poor Clares. And she was canonised as a saint only 2 years after she died in 1255. It's quite fun. I've put the reference on there, online, to the Bull of Canonisation, which is quite amusing. It makes great play with the pun on her name, Clare and Clarity, in the Latin and the English. So the English goes, starts, Clare, outstandingly clear with clear merits, in heaven with the clarity of great glory, on earth with the splendour of sublime miracles, is clearly clear. You can just see it. God, so clever. She governed her monastery and the family entrusted to her in it solicitly and prudently, in ministry studious, in exhortation attentive, diligent in admonition, in correction moderate, temperate in precepts, in compassion outstanding, discreet in silence, in speech mature, and well considered in all the things opportune to a perfect government. Quite interesting as a pope canonising a woman. It's not a particularly womanly list of virtues that he chooses. He specifically talks about admonition and study and government. the modern icon of her, which has a whole an extract from one of her writings, Place Your Mind Before the Mirror of Eternity. She talks a lot about contemplation. The full quote is, place your mind before the mirror of eternity. Place your soul in the brilliance of glory and transform your entire being into the image of the Godhead itself through contemplation. Claire was very influential in the direction of Christianity. Francis died fairly young, but Claire outlived him by many decades. And her insistence on protecting and keeping this mendicant rule of life, at a time when mendicant friars were considered very dodgy. The papacy and bishops were not at all sure that they wanted semi-autonomous holy people travelling around the country who weren't directly under their control and couldn't be controlled and relied on and checked for orthodoxy because they weren't in one place where they could be confined. And they certainly weren't sure they wanted women getting the kind of spiritual authority that you got from living this mendicant lifestyle. The poor Clares didn't move around, they were confined within their order. So her insistence and strength of mind she had in protecting that rule, very influential for the development of medieval Christianity, where the friars became very, very important. There were lots of other women as well who were involved in writing theological and liturgical texts in the early medieval period. Just throw out some names. Stories and Fables by a lady called Marie de France. Saints' Lives and Descriptions of Visions by, not just by Hildegard of Bingen, but by lots of other people. Elizabeth of Schoenau was very, very popular. All these things enjoyed a really wide circulation. They were copied and read out and circulated very widely around Europe, but still lots of manuscripts surviving. Women were historians. There's an example of 12th century Byzantine historian Anna Komnena, who wrote a book called The Alexiad, which shaped the Orthodox understanding of the First Crusades. Hymn writers and so on. And some of those roles could carry on as women's roles as theologians became more circumscribed. There are also, of course, some women, less so, but some very privileged aristocratic women who played very important roles in shaping the way in which the church and state interacts and develops in their political role. A good example is Matilda of Tuscany, who ruled huge areas of Lombardy and Tuscany in the 11th century, by all accounts with great expertise in both military and political affairs. And she was the primary Italian supporter, in political terms and in military terms, of the papacy during the investiture conflict I was talking about earlier. And given that clash between church and state was very, very influential in shaping the way that the medieval, not just the medieval Catholic Church, but actually the way in which medieval Europe developed, and I would argue in shaping the way the Reformation later developed, Matilda's intervention which probably helped mean that the papacy won in that debate eventually, was probably hugely influential. Talking about political women, of course, we also need to mention much later Elizabeth I, whose Elizabethan settlement really did shape not just the way Christianity has formed itself in this country, with the Church of England and other denominations having to react to it and against it and so on. But also through British missionary activity and cultural and commercial imperialism, political imperialism, has had huge amounts of influence on the way the Church has developed around the world. And Elizabeth, it very much was Elizabeth's personal view. I mean, the more I've studied the Reformation period in England, the more I've come to the view that the Elizabethan settlement really was what Elizabeth wanted. It was very shaped by her childhood history, by her personal relationship with her sister, Mary, and her mother, who she'd seen marginalised, and by her terror that England was going to be invaded by one of the other countries around, which she was determined to avoid happening. She hated preaching, Elizabeth. It's very funny, there's some sort of fascinating exchanges with bishops getting very annoyed with her because she won't give them licenses to preach. And she insisted, you know, we know about the Book of Common Prayer, but at the time, originally the Book of Common Prayer went along with the Book of Homilies, which was 12 approved sermons, and it was later added to. 12 approved sermons, the clergy were to just read out these sermons. Some of them are quite good. I mean, it's very interesting because they really are, people talk about 39 articles, but these sermons and the homilies really are what the theology of the Church of England was. It's a really interesting mix of Calvinism and a kind of general popular religion and an obsession with civic obedience. I mean, it's really terrifying, actually, how much of what the Church of England taught in the 17th century was, in the 16th, 17th century, was directed at you will obey and you will not challenge. So she wouldn't let anybody preach unless she gave them a particular license, because and she said she would far rather people didn't bother, because then they wouldn't risk getting it wrong. These were the safe, approved sermons. So another aspect of what's the next slide? Another aspect of women's theological writing that's been rediscovered in recent years, going back to what I was saying earlier, has been moved past, or skipped the whole middle of the age, I'm afraid. But moving past these early women and moving across to later times. After women were stopped from the influential role they'd had in the monasteries, and of course that completely came to an end. Up through the Middle Ages, you had medieval mystics and some nuns still able to work in that way. But after, even though they were marginalised and had less authority, after the Reformation, of course, in Protestant countries, monasteries were entirely stopped, and so even that avenue was closed to people. And one of the things that's been really rediscovered quite recently is that there were certain genres that were available to women, even when they couldn't do other things. They couldn't write academic theology as such, which is now very narrowly defined and controlled by the University of Church authorities, but they could do certain things. Best example, probably the best known example, is the medieval mystics, people like Julian of Norwich. It was still acceptable, just that there was a risk of getting burned as a witch, but it was just about acceptable for women to have spiritual visions, to have visions given to them in prayer, and to write those up. And people would often then come for spiritual advice and direction and so on. And often they were very highly valued, those charismatic gifts. And it does seem to be the case that women often were quite aware that the exercise of mystical and charismatic gifts was one way that they could have some authority. I don't want to sound too simple, but it was something that people were quite aware of. And it flourishes whenever there's a disruption in the fabric of society that means that there is some flexibility. So particularly, for example, the Civil War periods. In England, suddenly you've got all these dissenting groups and radical groups, it's not quite clear what's going to happen, and suddenly women are writing and publishing profusely. If you're interested in the Civil War period, there's a fascinating archive, you can get online through the National Archives, of all, well, pretty much, I think they reckon it's about 80% of the tracts that were published in the Civil War period, and the chap who kept, there was a chap who collected everything that was published at the time for future historians. He was thinking, this is important, all this stuff going on. And he collected everything for every site, everything he could find, he bought. Now, of course, a lot of them were deeply, deeply scurrilous and banned, so it was a very dangerous thing to do. He kept having to hide them under his floorboards and find new hiding places for them when his house was searched and things. But it survived, and this archive is now, it's been digitized, and you can just go online and read the originals of all these amazing things that were written. But a lot of women were writing then. But for quite a lot of the periods in late medieval and early modern Christianity. These sort of mystical visions and claims to direct spirit-led knowledge were considered very suspect. And it could be quite a dangerous thing to do at some periods. So even when you couldn't do that, there were some genres that women could write in. And probably the most obvious is poetry. Women writing poetry, as we've seen with Christine de Pizan, was perfectly acceptable. It was a nice womanly pursuit along with embroidery and so on. And with the invention of printing, women's poetry could be published acceptably and enjoy a very wide readership, often with a little preface saying, oh, I dreamt of publishing this, but you know, my bishop has insisted. It might help other people. Some of these poems, we also lost them as a big double. Some of them are actually very carefully argued theological treaties that have just been put into rhyming form. Or poetic form, as a way of making it acceptable to write theology. And my favourite example is Amelia Lanyon. We don't know if this portrait actually is her, somebody has claimed it is. But I thought my was a picture. She's been rather tenuously identified as somebody who might have been Shakespeare's Dark Lady, which has meant that in the last few decades, people have suddenly got interested in her, and so there are now editions of her work, which is nice. She wrote one book, published in 1611, called Salve Deus Rex Judaeorum, Hail God, King of the Jews. And as the title suggests, the poems are of great theological interest. They're also of great interest in the history of women's theological reflection on gender and on women in theology. The title poem, Hail God, King of the Jews, is a long narrative piece which depicts the passion from the point of view of women surrounding Jesus. Relatively unusual thing to do at the time, but a fairly conventional take on the passion, nevertheless. The most famous poem now is an astonishing piece of feminist theological polemic, Eve's Apology, which takes the story of Eve and the fact that people were saying that women didn't have the right to rule because Eve was to blame for all sin in the world, which had been particularly being reused in this period by some of those who were talking about the divine right of kings, which was becoming a very fashionable theory. And often that was based on a view going back to Eden. So this discussion of Adam and Eve was quite current as a basis for, you know, the king rules the queen just like men rule women, etc. And she starts off by arguing, if Adam was Lord and King of all the earth, before poor Eve had either life or breath, then, her fault, though great, yet he was most to blame. What weakness offers, strength might have refused. Being Lord of all, the greater was his shame. So she's arguing, well, you can't possibly blame, if you're going to say he was here first, then you can't also blame her. She then, in a very audacious move, goes on to point out that the apple was, after all, the fruit of the tree of knowledge, of good and evil. Therefore, if men are proud of having superior knowledge, they should thank women for giving it to them. One of my favourite quotes here. Men will boast of knowledge which he took from Eve's fair hand, as from a learned book. But the furious thrust of the poem is that although Eve might have initially taken the apple, it was men who condemned Jesus to die. So how dare they, if you're going to sit there taking biblical stories to be your argument, how dare men claim to be the superior sex when they killed Jesus? Her weakness did the serpent's words obey, you in malice God's dear son betray. Whom, if unjustly condemned to die, her sin was small to what you do commit. All mortal sins that do for vengeance cry are not to be compared unto it. Amen. And then let us have our liberty again and challenge to yourselves no sovereignty. Your fault being greater, why should you disdain our being your equals, free from tyranny? If one weak woman simply did offend, this sin of yours hath no excuse nor end. She was angry. It's an extraordinary piece of feminist theology, and it makes you wonder how many other women were saying or thinking similar things that we're rather unaware of in our limited view of history, which we do still see mainly through the lens of the male writers with whom we're more familiar and who still make up the canon. Another genre that was particularly available to women in the 16th and 17th century was the mother's legacy, a book of theology written or supposedly written whilst the woman was pregnant. Often these actually were written. Obviously, childbirth was something very dangerous at the time, and people would write letters to their just now, somebody gets cancer, don't they? And they write a letter to their children to be read when they're older. This was what was going on. People were pregnant, they were terrified they were going to die in childbirth. They were writing a letter to their child so that if it survived, they would teach them all the things they would have liked to say. But it then became a genre in itself, because you could write all sorts of theology pretending it was a letter of advice to your unborn child. They were often very substantial theological treatises, and they, again, enjoyed very wide sales. They were often published with a foreword saying, you know, since initial composition, I luckily survived, and all my friends have insisted it be published because people will find it very useful. There's a new book by somebody called Jennifer Heller, The Mother's Legacy in Early Modern England, which goes through about 20 of these. And she identifies that a lot of them are not just talking about the kind of things that a mother might want to teach her children. They extend this into, well, it's very important for my children to grow up in a stable country. So here's where I'll wade into how the church should be organised and how the state should be organised and how, what I think about political theology and so on. There's doctrines on the theology of the Eucharist, all sorts of things in there. And some of them, I've just realised we're talking for an hour, so I'm going to skip some of this. Some of them branched out into all sorts of other writing as well, having started with one of those and realised they had a market, and then moved on to reflections on psalms or collections of prayers. Particularly, you could write a collection of prayers that were helpful for family devotions and that kind of thing. Yeah, there were all sorts of ways that you could... It's an excruciatingly crawling experience reading the prefaces to these works. It's an excruciatingly crawling experience reading the preface of any 17th century book, isn't it? They're so disgustingly sycophantic. But the women's ones in particular, they're going, though I am but a weak and feeble woman, yet so many people have pleaded with me that this may be useful to a few of the humbler people. Anyway. They did what they had to do to get published. Don't we all? So I do think that the lens of Christian feminism, which started, 30, 40 years ago, has inspired historians and theologians to look back over the history of the church and see whether and what women did contribute. And in doing that, there's been a really rapid realisation that women have indeed done a great deal for the church, and not simply as faithful Christians, good mothers, teachers of the young, doers of good works, all the things that no one ever claimed that they didn't do. They've been active theologians, reformers, and commentators throughout Christian history. And they've even engaged with some of the debates that we would think of as feminist debates now. It would be anachronistic to use that term historically. At some periods, mainly, ironically, in what we now call the Dark Ages, they found this easier than in others. But the extent to which women's contributions have been there and have then been marginalised, I constantly find astonishing. I just want to end by saying, we're all academics, and we know from our own experience and interests that women, as well as men, have able, incisive, and analytical minds, and indeed that some women, presumably those of you over here, have minds that are more able, more incisive, and more analytical than most men. We just know that. That's the milieu in which we move. And the same has, of course, been true throughout history. Women's genetics hasn't suddenly changed in the last 50 years. Where the social and economic circumstances have made it possible, intellectual women have always sought to follow, not just to follow Christ, but to follow their vocation, if they've had one, to think, to write, and to influence the church. And I hope whatever your fields of academic inquiry, you will be inspired.
Do you mind taking a few questions?
I don't mind taking questions. I don't want to ask questions.
We'll have a discussion. Okay. We'll open it up. Does anyone have a question you'd like to start us off with?
If not, I will start us off with
the question. I had a couple questions. One, being just sort of a clarification, because you talked about this 1200 divide before and after, which is very important. So was there anything that women couldn't do before 1200?
It's not clear whether they were actually ordained as priests and bishops.
Okay.
There's some evidence that they were, but it's very limited. So it may well be that some were, but it was always quite unusual. Mm-hmm. There's a recent book, I think I put it on here, Gary Mason, The Hidden History of Women's Ordination, came out published by AUP about 4 years ago. It's just come out some paperback. And he identifies, I think, 6 examples of women being described as bishops, and a handful more of them being described as priests. It may well have been that a few bishops were ordaining them, but not very many. One of the key things there is this idea of the medieval church as a whole is a complete fantasy. Mm-hmm. You know, there was always the church in this place, the church in that place, and people didn't really know. Pope didn't really know what was going on in the corner of Germany or somewhere up in northern France. So there was huge variation, but it certainly wasn't ever very widespread.
So the functions they would have been involved in, you mentioned, were like lay readers, deacons.
Monasteries were hugely important. And it's hard to get back now, post-Reformation and dissolution of monasteries, just how important they were in everyday life. And so, of course, the vocation of being a nun was a perfectly obvious life choice for somebody. So, the kind of women who would go to university now would have gone into a monastery. And it was often, you didn't have to do it. Often widows went into monasteries later in life as well, so it could be a second career. It meant that, obviously, demands of childbirth always meant that if women were in the family, they tended to be rather circumscribed by that. But of course, before the Industrial Revolution, there wasn't this divide between men and women in the home and work, because the home was the work. They were the same. Both of you were working, and both of you were at home. There definitely were men's, what we consider to be men's and women's roles, but they were very different to how we consider men's and women's roles now. With the medieval concept of the good wife, there's the term the good wife, as in good, good morrow, good wife concept, that kind of thing. The good wife was a particular term used for a woman who was her husband's business partner. So you weren't a good wife because you were a good wife. You were a good wife if you looked after the wool business in partnership with your husband. So when he was off buying the wool for a couple of months, you'd run the shop and you might deal with the merchants from Florence or that kind of thing. It was quite a specific term for that, and very often they carried on running them after their husband's death as well, or if they had money of their own. Mm-hmm. It would be stupid to say that men and women were completely equal at that point, but it was very different to what we then later think of as being men's and women's roles.
Mm-hmm. And then, Richard, you mentioned, for example, that oftentimes the theme of reform is popping up in some of these women's writings. And I wondered if within more sort of contemporary women's theological voices, if there are themes at all that you see within the last 100 years or so that women have coalesced around, or has the training now been sort of parallel enough and women have made enough inroads that's harder to discern?
I think
you're more
than a Trinitarian systematic theologian, one of the Trinity, who says that she very deliberately went into a proper theological field so that nobody could say she was just doing something that was women's stuff. There seem to be a lot of women theologians seem to be historians, actually. more of an interest in challenging the status quo, as there is from say, from many black writers or gay writers, or something about not being part of the establishment tends maybe to make people more free to challenge it. Well, that's certainly the case of the Roman Catholic Church, where the men who are ordained aren't allowed to challenge certain things, so it's the women who have to, and often egged on to do it. My impression is that women tend to be less concerned with getting things right. That sort of scholastic sense of having to get the rules right and, you know, nobody's going to be safe unless they get it absolutely right. But that might be more down to the kind of education that they tend to have, tended to have in history. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other questions?
The term good wife. Do you think that comes from Proverbs 31?
Oh, yes, I'm sure. Yeah. Yes. Spinning and weaving and all sorts of activity. Good.
Because in the King James, that is the term you can find the good wife.
Yeah. Is Proverbs 31 what I'm thinking of? There's a whole section, isn't there, talking about wisdom and the good wife often being identified with the figure of wisdom and being this, the person who can be trusted and weaves and sails and make this one of things. I assume the point does come from that, but whether the term comes from that, I don't know.
Josh, you
I can ask her what kind of style that they were engaging with. Was it, I mean, obviously it was completely distinct from the in the kind of medieval period of the scholastic kind of debating style. Were they still engaging with that conversation?
They weren't particularly engaging with scholasticism. Scholasticism was very university based and women were almost entirely excluded from that particular academic conversation. And they don't seem to have been hugely interested in it. It might be that there are texts that people haven't found yet that they'll go and find, but I haven't come across anything yet of women saying, I really want to be in that scholastic conversation. They seem to have, in that period, they were focusing much more on biblical exegesis and on spiritual writing and on pastoral concerns. As they had been, you know, as men and women had been prior to that, but not so much the angels dancing on head in kind of academic questions. Now, I mean, who knows if there were women who were desperately wanting to. Personally, I've spent the last few years trying to do some research on the history of the doctrine of the Trinity, and trying to read medieval scholasticism on the doctrine of the Trinity is enough to make you want to go and bang your head against the wall. So I find it hard to believe that they were desperately trying to join that party, but maybe they were. But I think that was always a bit of an academic game, a bit of a kind of showing off and showing you've mastered the rules of the game. So if you weren't in that game.
Were there much differences within kind of different women authors, say? Would one respond to another, or is
there's no particular evidence. There's no particular evidence of the women having a separate women's conversation. You don't get Hildegard writing to another woman and saying, as a woman,
right,
I'd like to respond to that. They're responding to the other foremost academics of their day, whether they're male or female. There's not a sense of there being a women, certainly where they're acting and writing within that sort of monastic conversation, or later, apart from mother's legacies, which are very much situating themselves within that genre. and are written certainly ostensibly for other mothers to use with their children. That's the only genre I can think of where they're specifically addressing themselves to women and reacting to other women's writing in the same genre. But normally, they're not. There's certainly no evidence of it. Possibly partly because there were never that many of them at any one time.
Would they actually get specific in those mother's letters, saying, like, such and such in her mother's letter said this, but I say this?
They don't say, because the whole thing, because the constraints of the genre are that you're writing it to your unborn child.
Okay. Who probably wouldn't have read the other person.
Yeah, but they certainly show some awareness of the sort of thing that other people are saying. And also, actually, of the sort of thing that other people are saying in politics and more, there might be a section which a historian can tell is actually a thinly veiled riposte to X's arguments about the Trinity, which the woman disagrees with. But it doesn't say so in the text.
Okay, so you would never cite another person. No. If you would be, okay. Interesting.
So my question is kind of related to that, not just regarding the mother's legacy kind of stuff, but is there any indication how widely read women are in different periods?
I'm not a huge, I don't know very much about the history of libraries and the librarianship and so on, but there is quite a lot of research on it. You could go and find out with a lot of these how many copies there were in different libraries around the world and how many copies there still are existing and what historians think that means. It's never really an area I've got into particularly, but certainly with the later ones where they're printed, a lot of these went into many, many editions. And publishing Venice now was a very commercial enterprise, so they went to the second edition, so they're making a profit on them. And with the earlier ones, the manuscript ones, the fact that even one or two manuscripts survive suggests they were very widely copied. Certainly with things like Hilda von Bingen, there are copies in virtually all the important libraries, so they were clearly very widely known. What we don't know, of course, is how widely they were dispersed socially, because there's very little evidence for what normal people were reading. Until you start getting into, from about sort of 1450 or so, you start getting evidence of wills and inventories and things. And you can see which books they had. And they often had a copy of it. So you're talking sort of mercantile type of books. I mean, obviously, peasants didn't tend to leave all of them. They carried on living in the hall. But mercantile households would often have three or four books. And I can't just off my head think what they were, but there was a whole literature of books and book ownership and book reading. And there's a whole sub-literature of women's book ownership and book reading, which you could investigate if you wanted to.
And to kind of flip that from the writings themselves, are there indications of what texts those female writers are reading too?
Yes, I mean, again,
the texts that pop up.
Certainly in the early periods, the kind of academic disciplines of citation were only in their infancy, shall we say. So people don't tend to footnote and make it clear what they've read and so on. They were first things leaked by Christine Cadiz's letter, and actually she does refer to some text there so you can tell what she's arguing against and so on. And that's quite a good example, that one. Mm-hmm. She did say what the first book was, and she picked up a book and it was a particular notorious book and that annoyed her, and so she started reading her other books, and she doesn't tell them what the other books are. Mm-hmm. But people would have known the kind of books they would be. Sometimes things are titled a riposte to or a letter to or something. Particularly in that Civil War period, we get kind of a blast against Mr. such and such and his devilish popery of war. But yes, people who are experts in books can very often tell by the language and the quotations that are there, even if they're not cited, what they're engaging with. Because the main text they're engaging with is always the Bible. There's a huge amount of biblical quotations throughout. And it's very clear that lots of them were reading in the original text, and lots of them were making cross-level points about what the original Hebrew said and what the Greek was. And that kind of thing.
Any other questions?
Well,
John?
Well, to the other end of the publishing process, you also talked about the sycophantic, you know, approach of thanking everybody. But I then, to be quite honest, I'm completely ignorant of how publishing would work in the English period. So would, I mean, was it more along the lines of what we would think of as self-publishing? Or were these sort of texts being recognised by people who were then saying this is worth having a wider readership and therefore being copied or being printed ultimately?
It depends what period you're talking about. I mean, things that were being produced in monasteries were self-published to the extent that they were written, and then often people would ask for a copy, or a copy would be sent to a patron, and then they'd send, you know, they might have a copy made and sent to someone, but they might ask for more copies, or someone might ask for a copy, and so they would be copied within the monastery and sent out, so effectively self-published, on demand, printed on demand. They were also, of course, very, very widely plagiarized. So once you've got a copy, if you wanted to give a copy to someone else, they would have just copied it out, or someone else would copy it, or you'd have a copy. And there was no sense that you shouldn't do that. And occasionally things were printed under a completely different person's name, which you weren't meant to do, but just copying it was completely normal, because that was the only way you could. The copying shops in France, in Paris, were the sort of semi-industrial copying shops. Were primarily set up to supply the university, and they were supplying Bibles. You know, the Bible readership exploded in the 12th century. Suddenly, in a period of about 50 years, they went from being this size to this size, into the size of the Bibles now, and you know, just keeping your pockets. And they were very commercially driven. So they were making what would sell. And they were making. There was also a genre called Bible picture books, which, because you weren't meant to have the Bible in the vernacular, but what you did have were Bible stories in the vernacular, often highly illustrated, which were very widely circulated. It's funny how commercial publishers work. You go in, I don't know particularly about the commercial ones, but they would print them and sell them, I think. Certainly, as soon as you get into early printing, you get people in Geneva. You get the same printer printing the Catholic index of forbidden books for Vatican, and going and then later on that same day printing one of the forbidden books for sale. They'll just take any commission and they'll print anything they'll sell.
All right. Well, I think we'll go ahead and wrap up there. Thank you so much. You guys want to join me in thanking Ray?
Business cards.